Welcome to the Scariest Things Podcast, your gateway to the trends and tropes of the horror genre. Episode 22.
22.
The Golden Age of Horror.
Deuce, deuce.
So, 22, and we're still ticking. Can't get rid of us. We're here for good.
Deuce, deuce.
So we've been, I think, talking a lot about the various eras of
horror. We've been talking a lot about horror.
Yes, and there are, and I think within horror, I think that you know, I've often said we're in a new golden age of horror.
Right.
Which suggests that there is a original golden age
what
of horror.
What is the original golden age of horror?
And
help us out.
And so
I was confused by this.
I've had to walk through Mike with this a couple of times. It's a little and to be honest, go slower.
It's too much. My head's going to explode.
I think where Mike likes the notion of a cut and dried, divided up by decades, and each decade is in itself an era.
Lumper or splitter?
A lumper?
Eric's a lumper.
Okay.
I'm a splitter.
An aggregator is what I'd like to say.
Yeah. Lumper is a little pejorative. All right, lumper.
No fat shaming here. You know, I when I sort of look at cinema and a timeline of the major trends in horror, this is what I see. I think the very beginning of horror cinema sort of coincided with what is commonly called the Golden Age of Hollywood.
Right.
But I think we'll go into since we're going to talk about the Golden Age. You know what? How do we define that?
Because golden age more 30s. Once you get into the talkies,
right, and then you get a little
music thrown in there,
and then it's slowly the next big trend that you would see that there was a real quiet period after all those great Universal movies, and then eventually it became more kid friendly and it became matinee
Saturday afternoon matinees and monsters.
Yeah, and in a way that sort of reflected the psychology of the times.
Yeah,
it was
because everything was an allegory
safer,
for the Cold War,
right? And
film in the 1950s was an allegory for the Cold War.
Big monsters.
Yes,
you heard
it here first.
But then
no one has ever come up with that analysis.
Yes.
Ever. We're the first.
Yes. Radiation, Cold War.
Copyright that.
Done. And then you start getting into the era where they pulled the restrictions out from what you can do with movies. And I think certainly Psycho and Night of the Living Dead really pushed at the boundaries of the censorship and what's allowable, and then as soon as they pulled they allowed R-rated movies and X-rated movies, you got Grindhouse,
right,
and that lasted for a good long while, and then the character of some of these Grindhouse movies changed.
Pornography is profitable. Pornography is profitable.
Yeah, there's the cousin.
That's the moral to that story. Grindhouse is profitable. Why it's still not going on to this day, I have no idea. Well, I guess because of the internet. Stupid internet.
Mike's holding a grudge. And I think what a lot of people would commonly refer to the 1980s movies.
The VHS era. Yep.
Betamax,
if you prefer.
Yeah, Betamax wasn't really. It kind of crapped out in like in 84, 85.
Yeah, it kicked around for like a solid 5-6 years, I think. Yeah,
and then the big disc laser players. I think Chris Rolfe had one, and nobody else did.
Yes, he did.
Before the DVD era, and the DVD era, I think began when I refer to as the horror drought.
Yeah.
That sort of coincides with the 90s, and then kind of feeds into the mid 2000s until where we hit this new golden age of horror.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was a dead spot where horror films lost their way.
Right,
that they became either too commercial or too small, and that they weren't. You didn't get that nice mix of highbrow and the grindhouse fun ones, and then the big budget, and you had a lot of copycat stuff, lots of retreads and remakes that just they didn't cut it, and now we're in this era where everything is.
It's an awesome mix of stuff.
Going
back to the 1990s and early 2000s, I suspect the reason why there was sort of a drought of horror was because DVD made everything so easily, it made it so easy to replicate these films, and there was so much gray market stuff floating out there. I think you saw this huge spike in terms of all these weird little video stores, video projects, where they could easily replicate stuff that was maybe on the edge of copyrighted, maybe on the edge of legal. And they were able to generate all that. So I think people then took time to go back in time and look at stuff from the 50s, 60s, 70s that had otherwise been either never available on VHS or if it was available on VHS, it was a horrible dub. And now I think the DVD technology made it easier for people to kind of go back and consume a lot of that stuff. So there was no reason at that point to make a lot of good horror films, or you didn't even have to think about it.
Yeah, and there weren't a whole lot of really high. I think Hollywood, I think, gets accused, and I think in this same era of not coming up with new ideas,
right?
And then there's like, how come that we don't get any new stuff? Everything's a sequel, and I think that was particularly true for horror movies. You just cut.
In the 90s and early 2000s. Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. But we'll be getting to that decade at some point.
So those,
or that era at some point.
Yeah. We're working
on defining that era.
You're going to have to deal with a lot of exposition here. And for that, I kind of apologize. I kind of don't. Because I kind of want to get away from the idea that it is explicitly the decade that defines the era.
Right.
I think. It's all these things are classically tied to other events of the times. I think that I think the 1940s, you saw a largely the disappearance of horror movies. I think World War II had something to do with that. I think that the what Hollywood was allowed to produce, and that they didn't want to do a lot of real scary downer movies because life was scary enough as it was. During World War II.
But here, this is the thing that I think is so interesting about the 1920s, the front end of the Golden Age, the Golden Era, and the thing that defined it was that the fact there was no sound, or there was music, oftentimes accompanied in theater by the film. There were no words spoken. And to actually sit down and watch a silent film, you really have to readjust your whole head. And you have to really, really pay attention to what's going on the screen, and you have to really pay attention to facial cues. You have to pay attention to acting,
and then they acting,
capital
and it's like,
A acting,
and where the woman will throw back her arms and let loose what's apparently a scream.
Yeah. So you really got to pay attention to that kind of stuff because, and it's not just like sitting down and watching. My Bloody Valentine in 3D again for the fourth time. It's actually like you have to pay attention.
Yep.
And to me, I think that's a pretty big component of the stuff from the 1920s, the early end of the golden age.
The golden age. And I don't know if you've seen it. There was an homage that our friend and colleague Robert reviewed, The Call of Cthulhu, which was a black and white silent movie with subtitles with the little cue cards that would come in between. It's like, oh no, and have that in all caps, which was a wonderful homage because that was. 1920s was traditionally thought of as H.P. Lovecraft era. When he did the bulk of his writing.
The other really cool thing about the stuff from the 1920s, speaking of gray market and speaking of stuff out of print and copyright issues and legal questions, all that stuff is online. And the really interesting thing is that because a lot of the original scores that were rendered with the film or the original music that went along with a lot of those films is long gone and long lost. people have cut new soundtracks to this. Yeah, so you can see all of that stuff online for free. Go to YouTube.
Yeah.
You can check out all these films, and you can see. And a lot of them are in really, really good shape, and the quality is really spectacular.
And one of my key movies that I'm going to mention as far as the 1920s, I saw at the Hollywood Theater with exactly what you're describing, with a live performance by a musician who was cutting a new soundtrack for this film,
the movie.
And with that, I think what
Let's get to it.
What I would like to do is begin.
Take a deep breath. Once upon a time, it all began
with, I'm going to run
December of 1919. A young man had a dream. No. Okay, where are we going?
The film that I'm referring to that I saw at the Hollywood was The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
Very nice, yes.
And as it was stunning how good the film quality was on this. And we are fortunate enough here in Portland to have the Hollywood Theater and their director of operations, Dan Halstead.
Yeah.
Who is a film archivist, and he goes out and he hunts down particularly kung fu movies and grindhouse stuff. But he also found a very good copy of The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, and there was a cellist who came in and did the soundtrack. And it was weird, trippy stuff.
I think we're going to see a lot of that tonight. Weird, trippy.
Classic, you know, with cardboard cutout.
Right.
Kind of stage backdrops. You realize that there's a transition in cinema at the time that was very, very closely associated with stage dramas.
Right.
Right. Where they still had flies.
Right.
And scrims. And, right. And you could see the things so drop in and drop out.
What year was Dr.
1920.
So it was on the button.
Yeah. So this is what I would propose is maybe the start, but it isn't as necessarily as scary as the next classic one that I've got on my list, and I know that we usually do a fearsome foursome,
right?
But in this, we're playing a little. It's a little bit more of
a call and response kind of thing. This is a think piece. You gotta stick with us as we noodle on the 1920s. You know, the other thing that strikes me about the 1920s before I get into my first film is that, you know, we're Eric and I are of the age group. I won't disclose that age group, but you know, our parents were certainly cognizant of this, and they grew up with a lot of these films. And I think a lot of these films from the 1920s, 1930s, that era, the icons of the screen, a lot of the images of the screen were still very, very much part of the psyche of the 1960s and 1970s. I mean, I think about, you know, when I would go, like my parents would go out to, you know, the import market, and they would have the poster section. You would look through all the posters, and there would be, you know, there would be The Hunchback of Notre Dame. There would be Godzilla. Mm-hmm. There would be, you know, Dracula. So a lot of that imagery, even though I might not have ever seen those films, it was seared into my brain from a very early age. And I think it's because that it carried forward several decades after. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know that, you know, Scream or Friday the 13th. I mean, these films likely will carry forward, and you know, for many generations and kids from, you know, 30 years old from now who, you know, didn't grow up with Friday the 13th will probably still be talking about Friday the 13th. But I think that's the other thing that's kind of interesting is the longevity of some of this.
Well, now,
the lasting power.
Is the first film on your list one that you think that has staying power that people recognize now?
No. I think it has an incredible staying power with a very small subset, a very obsessive horror fan base on planet Earth. Of course, I'm talking about the 1922 Swedish-Danish sort of faux documentary Hacksan.
Yep.
Hacksan, also known as Hacksan, the Witches or Witchcraft Through the Ages.
Yes.
So I saw this. I was first exposed to Hacksan, I think it was in college. In fact, I think I saw all these films in college. Thank you, Telecommunications and Film 101, because otherwise I probably would have never seen these films. I think that was the first time I saw Haxan, and I remember thinking, boy, this is really weird. I actually went back and rewatched a lot of it, not all of it, but a good portion of it this week. Haxan is one of the strangest films I've ever seen in my life, and I kept thinking as I was watching it, my God, what would this thing look like if somebody tried to make it in 2018?
Because purportedly a documentary, but it could be anything. It couldn't be further from the truth.
The interesting thing is, like, the bookends of the film, so it's broken into seven parts, these sort of like these scholarly dissertations on witches and demons and the church and mental illness and all sorts of other crazy crap. But the bookends kind of give you kind of the religious foundation and explain to you what's going on. And then at the tail end of the film, they sort of say, you know, much of this is like folklore, much of it's just superstition, some of it's mental health, some of it's, you know, us as human beings evolving and understanding that the old lady that lives down the street is maybe just an old lady that lives down the street.
And not a witch.
But the thing that is so incredibly fascinating about this is that for 1922, and that's why I say again, I think it would be so amazing to see if anybody could ever take a film like this and try to recraft it, because, you know, when it first came out, it was straight up banned in the United States. They wouldn't even, like, let the film be imported because it had all these horrible graphic depictions of torture and nudity and sexual perversion. And to see it now is still, I think it's super shocking. Super duper shocking.
And I think that there was something about the 1920s, which had the bit of the laissez-faire before sort of the moral standards of cinema had been set. And I think by and large that got established in the 30s.
Right.
And then really got enforced in the 40s. And I think that was much to the detriment of horror movies.
Yeah.
That I think that the more conservatism comes working its way post-World War II. Mm-hmm. Everybody settle down and don't worry. Just worry about the commies and radiation, but you don't have to worry about witches and demons, devils, and we won't show any boob flesh.
You know, the other thing I'll say too is that this is better than anything Rob Zombie's ever done. And in fact, I know we talked about the Lords of Salem, and Rob Zombie took this very, like, it was like he took the homework assignment about, you know, witches and demons and Satan and said, I'm going to take this super literal approach in the context of Lords of Salem. And this film doesn't actually take a literal approach. I mean, it obviously, at the front end, you know, gives you, again, this very scholarly dissertation about what witches are. But as you go through the film and you're watching it, a lot of it's very subtle. Some of it, you know, some of it is not so subtle. But it's you know, you see goats, you see, you know, the demons, you see these poor, you know, tortured women, you see these, you know, tyrannical, you know, monks and friars who are hassling these witches. So much more powerful, again, than, you know, the sort of the hackneyed approach that Rob Zombie's taken with a lot of his films.
And I bet you it was a lot more shocking for audiences back then than Rob Zombie stuff is for audiences now.
Oh, yeah. Can you imagine, like, 1920 rolling into the theater and peeping something like Haxan? I mean, it would twist your... I mean, it twisted my head straight off, and I've been watching this crap for 40 years, and to think...
Well, I have only seen portions of Haxan, but some things that I recall...
Did you see The Witch's Sabbath? That is shocking.
I remember, I don't remember exactly what the scene, but there was, like, women being accused, and there was, like, tied to a tree, and then there would be, like, this person who, there would be a puff of smoke, and then there would be a devil shows up, and that was sort of, at the time, it was magic. I mean, it was the dawn of special effects. Georges Méliès and all that kind of stuff sort of taught... the first generation of filmmakers the kinds of tricks you can play, and then you get these
full of those tricks,
and you get a lot of the people sort of jumping in surprise, like, oh, it's the devil,
right? Well, you know, I think Haxan, I don't know if this is true or not, but I'm just going to say it because I think it is. I think it was one of the first jump scares of all time. There's a scene where one of the monks is sitting down, I believe he's sitting down at his desk, and the devil, played by the director plays the devil throughout all these sequences. He jumps up out of nowhere, and the monk friar, you know, bolts from there, like incredibly shocked that to see that the devil is jumping up like that. But yeah, the special effects are absolutely dazzling. It's, you know, I think it's the director, whose name I'm going to blank on right now. Mm-hmm. He did stuff that, I mean, frankly, in some cases, they've really never been able to replicate. Yeah. And it took many people years and years later to even replicate the portions of the film that they could replicate. So Haxan, super weird.
I will contest that the first jump scare was Haxan.
Yes.
Because I'm going to bring out its cousin movie that came out. That very same year, 1922.
Lay it on me. 1922. Okay.
F.W. Murnau's
yes.
classic Nosferatu.
Oh, yeah.
Right? I don't know that there is a scarier vampire than Max Schreck as Nosferatu.
Wow. It's just... You're laying it down. Now, have you seen Nosferatu?
I have seen Nosferatu. Because
Eric has not seen Dracula. In the interest of full disclosure.
I've not seen Bela Lugosi.
Seen Nosferatu.
Nosferatu is one of the creepiest... And he's so disfigured in the way that he comes out of the shadows and he just does... It doesn't look human. I mean, even with... And the makeup or the prosthetics that they use, so horrible. He's this emaciated actor,
right?
And he walks, and it actually plays very well to the jerkiness inherent to films of that era, that they didn't have the film speed and the film quality of to do smooth movement, and I, you know what I'm talking about with whether it's Charlie Chaplin or Buster Keaton or any of these things. They seem to be moving at either half speed or double speed. They don't seem to be moving normal speed. And when you see the shadow of the vampire crossing across the window or see him emerging out of the shadows, it is unearthly. Yeah. And maybe it's not so much of the jump scare, because he really does loom more than he does the, you know, and I think so much tied to jump scares nowadays is with the pan left, nobody there. Right. Pan right, nobody there. Pan left, oh no, monster! And then cue the loud music.
Right. In this case, there wasn't loud music.
Well, there could have been in the theater. It might be someone on a piano. Dun 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 dun. You know, that kind of thing.
No, I think Nosferatu had like that sort of impending doom quality, which was what we wanted to call the podcast originally.
But somebody else has already.
Damn it! I think it had that kind of quality where it was just like this darkness. And this kind of this as you put it, this sort of looming this looming figure that was kind of around every corner. Not so much the jump scare, but definitely a darkness.
And taking advantage of it's black and white,
right?
And you're playing with shadow and what you can't see and what you can see. And it was, I think, a legit scary movie, still scary to this day.
Mm-hmm. When was the last time you saw Nosferatu?
Oh, it's been a long time since I saw Nosferatu. I think it was back after college or something that. I think it was playing at the Bijou Theater in Eugene.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
So, I mean, that was the...
I remember my uncle was kind of still is kind of a film buff. And I remember I had a couple cousins that were slightly younger. And it was back in the day when you could go to the library and you could rent, you know, like old 35mm reels, or you could rent, you know, 16mm reels. I can't remember what flavor this was, but he got, and they were always like, it was never the original film. It was like a shortened version of that film, because obviously the library's not going to check out like 10 film canisters. And he showed us, I was probably, I don't know, like 11 or something. Mm-hmm. And my cousins were like 8 and like 6, and he was like, "We're gonna watch Nosferatu."
Oh man!
And I remember thinking, "I'm terrified." Yeah. I'm 11. I'm the oldest of the bunch, and I remember thinking, "This is really freaky." Like, why are we even watching Nosferatu?
The still photos of Nosferatu are freaky.
Oh yeah,
I mean,
and that's kind of what I was talking about earlier too. Is maybe not so much Nosferatu, but it's those icons of film. Those things still stick. And I think, you know, we were definitely part of that generation where they were they were definitely, definitely embedded in that collective consciousness of you know, the 60s, the 70s, 80s, is that, you know, people still knew, and they could tell you what Nosferatu was.
There was sort of kept alive, and I haven't seen the movie, and it's one of these movies that I probably, I should go check out, Shadow of the Vampire.
Which
was about the filming of Nosferatu, right. And it's...
with Willem Dafoe.
Willem Dafoe playing Max Schreck.
Yeah.
And...
I have not seen that either, but that would be a good one to check out.
Interesting commentary on that, and... Apparently, Max Schreck was a really screwed up dude.
Right.
And I think he had like an opium habit.
There you go.
Something.
Everybody was an opium addict back then.
So what?
H.P. Lovecraft, Max Schreck, they all were.
Or absinthe or something like that.
The good stuff. All right. I'm moving up a couple years to the 1925 silent horror film classic Phantom of the Opera, starring Lon Chaney Sr.
Collision.
In the title role. We got a crossover.
Yeah.
It was almost invariable. It was inevitable that we would have a crossover.
You have to have Lon Chaney in there. When I was a kid, going through the famous monster movies of yore.
Yep. Yeah, you pick up a copy of Famous Monsters of Filmland, you pick up a copy of Mad Magazine or Cracked Magazine, or any of those film magazines from the 60s and 70s, you're going to see a friggin' picture of Lon Chaney.
And the crazy thing is, he put hooks in his nose. He did weird things to get to really distort his physical features that went above and beyond. It wasn't just
the
mask.
He took wire. What he did was he took wire and he wrapped it around his head, forcing his nose upwards. Yeah. And then he put, he was more Tom Savini than Tom Savini. He was doing all of his own special effects and makeup. Yeah. And in fact, he was totally insistent before the film came out that he wanted to make absolutely sure, absolutely 100% sure that the theater wasn't, or that the studio rather, wasn't going to leak any photos of him as the Phantom of the Opera as promotional. He wanted to make sure that when people came into the theaters, they were seeing the Phantom of the Opera for the first time, especially the end scene where the mask gets lifted off, because he wanted people to be legitimately freaked out. And I thought, boy, what a clever thing. And, you know, so tough to do in this day and age, because now
spoiler alert,
and you can watch the movie, you know, 5 months before it actually gets released.
So I think he also was in the first, speaking of something that predates the 20s, The Hunchback.
Yeah.
He was Quasimodo, wasn't he?
Mm. But the Hunchback you're referring to is not... Yeah. The Hunchback of Notre Dame. It's the Hunchback something. It's not the Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Right. Hunchback of Notre Dame was Charles Laughton in 1939.
Yeah.
But he played Quasimodo in an earlier film adaptation.
Yeah.
And so it was a man of a thousand faces, right? Lon Chaney.
Yeah.
But this is, I think, what everybody will remember Lon Chaney. I mean, they remember a lot of stuff about Lon Chaney, but this is the picture of him that lasts with.
That end scene. Oh my god!
And it's like where they
lift the mask off. You still watch that? It's still shocking to this day. Still shocking. Yeah. You know, the interesting thing about the Phantom of the Opera was that, you know, when the talkies started to come around in the late 20s, they decided they were going to recut it, but there was apparently like some contractual. There were some contractual issues with Lon Chaney, and they weren't able to use his voice because he was under contract with some other studio.
Did he ever do talkies? Did he ever get to that point?
Oh yeah, I think he did. Okay. Yeah. But the thing that's interesting about this, so they used they reshot some of the stuff. They reused a lot of the old stuff. They colorized it. They brought in the talking, but again, the Lon Chaney piece, there's no talking in the 1929 re-release.
Okay.
1929, 1930 re-release. Yeah. So interesting stuff. Interesting stuff for sure. The sound version, I guess it was 1930.
Okay.
The sound version came out in 1930.
He died young.
He did. I don't know when he died. But the thing was brilliant about that was in terms of the transition that we're talking about, mm-hmm. was that he did, obviously did the earlier film, and then the latter film came out in 1930, and they made another $1 million.
He died in 1930.
Okay.
And at age 47.
Yeah. Okay.
Then his son took up the mantle and became the Wolfman.
That's right. Yeah. Lon Chaney Jr. Yeah. Yeah. So, super interesting stuff. Super interesting stuff. So they did, I guess they did add in the 1930 version, the mirror scene, they had a new character to be the Phantom's voice. But it was all Lon Chaney at that point, so they just dubbed it over.
Yeah, yeah, but that's not what people remember the 25. I mean, that was the one that first made the impact. And mm-hmm. I always think of it in black and white. Just the fact that they would colorize it just seems odd.
Right.
So I think that those were sort of the stalwarts of the 1920s.
Oh, I got one more.
Oh, you do.
I got one more.
Okay,
unless you want to go.
Keep going.
You get on it.
What else you got in the 20s?
One more on the 20s, and this is actually going all the way back to the early 20s, early 20s.
Yeah.
I don't know that this is a film that you could say started the 1920s. I mean, because obviously now I'm going like totally, totally cattywampus out of order because I went 20, 25, now I'm going, or I went 22, 25, now I'm going 20. This is Gollum. How he came into the world.
This is part three
of the Gollum series.
Honestly, this is a collision, but the fact that this is one that I'm just really not familiar with, I couldn't expound on it. So why don't you go ahead and inform us about the Gollum? All I know is that it was this big clay guy with a bowl cut.
Yeah. So it's based on Jewish folklore,
mm-hmm.
and the basic gist of the story is set in a Jewish ghetto in Prague, mm-hmm. Obviously in the 1920s, and a rabbi in the community, Rabbi Lowe, he predicts this disaster and that the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire is going to lay siege upon the people of Prague, and mm-hmm. something has to be done. And he decides that instead of adhering to the decree from the Roman Empire, which that all Jews must leave the city of Prague, he decides to create this clay golem. He goes, he prays to God and God tells him what to do. And so he creates this clay golem to fight, the Roman Empire. And, the thing that's interesting about it is it's sort of like it's Frankenstein pre-Frankenstein. Mm-hmm. Right. And again, the thing is that with Haxan, the guy who directed Haxan, played the devil. In this case, the guy that directed Gollum played the Gollum.
Okay.
You mean the director? The director. Yeah, the director played the Gollum. Paul Wegener. I think one of the interesting things about this is obviously there's a bunch of sort of like Jewish mysticism. There's obviously some sort of like reverse anti-Semitism going on at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that's really...
This is a German film, correct?
Yeah, it's a German film, okay. Right. But the thing that's really interesting is that it sort of gets into a lot of the same topics as, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, mm-hmm. which obviously predated the Gollum, but then, of course, the Gollum predated the Frankenstein film version. But it's essentially the same story because the rabbi in the film, they put the Gollum down, but then one of the rabbis... Mm-hmm. The rabbi was trying to defend the city, but then they put the golem down. They're like, okay, enough of this. One of the rabbi's contemporaries decides to re-resurrect the golem, and that's when the golem gets totally crazy. And so it gets into this whole like man's inhumanity to man, and the inability to control Mother Nature, and all these kind of like great tropes that sort of are sprinkled throughout the history of horror. But
you do see strong influence on Frankenstein and early zombie movies like White Zombie and things like that. You can also make the case for Jason and the Argonauts and Talos, the bronze,
right.
The bronze giant, where you summon a defender, you animate a statue. I think that is the classic tale of golems.
Mm-hmm.
And I think or animating the flesh.
Right.
And so this is a fable trope.
Right.
Put to screen. And a lot of these things, the great thing about these 1920s movies is these are the first time that people, I mean, before then it would just be things that you told your kid and to scary stories around the campfire. And right. Now they are now you actually get
to show it to them.
So I guess there had been some things like Der Fledermaus and some other things that were maybe operas that dealt with some things. But I think because of the trickery that you could do with early cinema, these things became really popular, and as it shifts into more of the Golden Age, it really strikes home with a large audience. Mm-hmm. I think that these first ones give you the flavor of what's to come, and it really is. They are the true benchmarks of everything on horror movies built upon the backs of these first few movies that says we can scare you. That this is one of the reasons why you go to a cinema is to experience fear.
Built on the backs of a clay monster.
Yes.
The Golem, though, actually, the original Golem predates 1920. So this was the first of three films. The Golem, mm-hmm. which is the first one, came out in 1915. Mm-hmm. And apparently there's only like 6 minutes.
Yeah. I noticed that too.
That film that actually exists. The rest of the film is lost to time. It doesn't exist anymore. The second film, which was apparently a parody of the first film that the same guy did,
okay,
which is called The Golem and the Dancing Girl, that film literally doesn't exist anymore. That was done in 1970.
So the original remake.
Yes, the original remake does not exist. That was done in 1917, and then in 1920, mm-hmm. they decided to go back to the Golem franchise because it was so successful and do the third one.
Like, which I know is what you did last summer, part two, Golem right. Strikes Back.
Right, right. Can you imagine if Jaws 3 in 3D was the only one left of the Jaws franchise? And people were like, well, I guess that's the best one because that's the only one that's left.
I heard the first one was actually pretty good, but this one I'm not so sure about.
I'm sticking with Jaws 3D. Jaws 3 in 3D.
Stinker. So, okay.
That's all I got. That's 1920s. Boom. Done.
But what we've done is we've established these are the greatest of the early films in horror.
Right.
And if you were going to benchmark the horror movies to say this is... There is a before and after. I mean, and when we get to later mm-hmm. movies in this discussion of the eras, you can say pivotal key movie that changed the tenor of horror movies.
Oh, which one do I think it is?
Which one do you think is like changed them?
I'll tell you. I will tell you. I have an answer for that. I have a definitive answer. I have a quantitative answer.
Gimme.
It is Phantom of the Opera. And here's why. Yeah. Because Phantom of the Opera was the thing that inspired Universal to finance because they were like, holy crap, you can actually go out and scare people and you can make money. And that allowed Universal to go out and finance and start the long string, the Draculas, the Frankensteins.
And it had a bona fide star in it.
The Invisible Man, the Mummy, and on and on and on.
So I would agree with you, actually.
Phantom of the Opera.
So we are putting a flagpole down the start of the golden age of horror films, Phantom of the Opera.
Yes.
Okay.
The first and greatest.
So, that benchmark allows us to get into what we'll talk about in a future podcast, which will be the peak movies of the era. What is the high point of the golden age of horror? And we got a lot to pick from.
Oh my gosh! Because we're just started. We're at the front end of the golden age.
With the embarrassing caveat that Eric has not seen one of the key films of the golden age, that being Dracula,
promised to watch it.
I will have to
He promised Lucifer himself that he would be watching Dracula.
Swear on my grandmother's grave that I will watch Dracula. Less Dracula.
Gotta watch Dracula.
So
let's get to grave digging.
So grave digging, Mike, why don't you go ahead and start?
Well, so my grave digging is kind of a continuation from podcast number 21, where we talked about those films that we were ashamed that we haven't seen. And I wanted to report back because did my homework.
Okay.
I did not watch all six films. I watched two of the six, which is pretty good. And? That's a good clip. So I watched The Orphanage, which is brilliant.
Okay.
All in Spanish. Wonderful film. Great cast. Perfectly believable acting. Some legitimately terrifying scenes. And kind of in that vein of, you know, Guillermo del Toro films, sort of this kind but fantastical quality set to a horror film. So it's not just straight up, you know, hacking and slashing.
Storytelling?
But there's some storytelling, and it's really interesting. It's really, really interesting, and there's some legitimate scares. And number two, in my grave digging efforts, was Don't Breathe, which also super solid film, and I'm ashamed that I haven't seen either of those films. I really liked Don't Breathe. My only complaint, and I've talked to a couple of people about this, was I felt like, and this is a spoiler alert, so turn the podcast off right now if you don't want to hear this. I felt like the killer in this case, not the kids in the house, but the blind man inhabiting.
Granted,
the house,
these kids are also crooks.
They're also killers. Yeah,
they're not killers. They're criminals, but they're not killers.
Well, they turn out to be killers.
Well, interesting.
Kind of, sort of. Yeah. There is no protagonist in this film. They are all tragic. They're not tragic heroes. They're tragic villains. They're all terrible people. Mm-hmm. I kind of felt like he shouldn't have talked, because he has some lines in the film which don't really add much to the film, because I thought in a really clever way, they tell you why he's doing what he's doing. They tell you what he's up to, and you don't need to have him then subsequently come on the screen tell you why he's telling you what you've already been told.
I don't know that that's necessary, because I also don't think that we needed to make him into a Jason Voorhees character, a silent, brutal monster. I think that that he is, he's extremely physical. He's more capable than any of the
but
the
he really is a
silent,
house. Brutal monster, though. He's a silent, brutal monster, and
I think that he's, because he's been living alone, or sort of living alone, he's somebody.
spoiler alert, part two.
Turkey baster, spoiler alert. Oh, that made, that, that.
Did, that, was, did, that was pretty grisly, yeah. That was
so
pretty
you missed out in the theater when they realized what the turkey baster is for, the groan in the audience, particularly the women in the audience, go, oh!
That's what I did on my couch.
Yeah, that was...
I did the same thing.
It was... That is King Yucky right there.
But I think had he not spoken, he would have taken on more of a Jason Voorhees kind of supernatural killing machine, Michael Myers kind of quality, which would have, I think, recalibrated the whole thing into more of a horror.
Less thriller. Yeah. No, I agree with you there, but I think the plausibility of, you know, I think that they weren't trying to set up a supernatural story.
Sure.
And so it was more of, you know, it's the reverse home invasion.
Yeah.
But you went into the wrong house.
Yeah. Right? Very clever, very believable, great sets, great locations, rundown Detroit. There's all sorts of allegory to the economic collapse of Detroit that's really interesting, which we won't bore you with tonight. But yes, both films, two of the six that I was able to check
your
out.
Shameful list.
On my shameful list. I can now tell you officially, I'm officially ashamed that I hadn't seen those, but I feel like redemption is upon me.
Okay.
It's here. Redemption is here. All right, so what do you got when you went grave digging?
So
when you went grave digging.
When I went grave digging, it's an announcement. Our hometown of Portland, Oregon, we are having the Portland Horror Film Festival coming up.
Yeah! Get on it!
May 25th is going to be, they're going to have a preview, and I have to thank Mike for cueing me into this. That they're calling the Satanic Panic.
Satanic Panic, and then the night after is The Gate. So they're showing, they're showing
Satanic. Oh, the classic, the Gate from the 1980s.
Yeah, yeah. So there's the first one, so they're doing Satanic Panic, and I can't remember the movie. Then the next night.
It's Satan's Asylum, a 1972 film.
Satan's Asylum, and then the following night is The Gate.
And in between, they're also doing a bunch of devil-themed short films.
Yes.
So, but that's just sort of a teaser to the main event, which is happening from June 13th to June the 16th.
Heck yeah.
And so far, they haven't yet announced the full slate of films. There are two films. Both of them, I think, are Italian.
Cool.
One is called The Frame, and this one looks to be nasty. In a way that we horror films will enjoy the nasty.
Video nasty, just nasty.
Yeah, well, it'll be cinema nasty because
maybe video nasty.
Saw someone like biting a guy and pulling the flesh off his arms or something like that. It was kind of nasty looking.
All right,
but it's sort of a group of friends get together and there are three strange invaders come in and then they start
zombies.
They kidnap this party and they make them play these twisted moral games. We've seen these kinds of things with the there's another one that recently came out where it's like maybe it's Wish Upon or one of these ones where everybody has to stand around I dare you to do or right. Truth or Dare
yeah.
Which I don't know, Truth or Dare, you guys probably may want us to see it just to give it a review. It looks like shit. But
ooh, you heard it there first.
Yeah, a hot take. It's probably the
hot shit hot take.
But anyways, this ooh, one seems steamy. Like this one that they start live streaming, it becomes a bit of a torture show. So this one could be a hard watch. The Fest directors note that this is one of the most brilliantly candy-colored and joyously bloody and gory films we've seen in a long time. It's an awesome ride from start to finish, but not for the faint of heart.
Get to Portland now.
Yeah.
Get your tickets.
And then the other one, feature film that they've announced is something called La Place's Demon.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks to be like a haunted house kind of movie where the house is sort of this intricate clockwork piece where that they can see chess pieces moving around in the house, and then things room the house starts changing on them while they're in it.
I think that was Saw 4.
Yeah,
maybe Saw 5.
So shout out to Darren Bousman for Saw 4.
Yeah,
but the movie to me when I looked at I posted both of the trailers in a recent update on scariestthings.com. One T.
Yep.
And so you can get a look for yourself, but I think that the cinematography looks like Sin City. It's
cool.
It's a black and white,
interesting,
high contrast, really high def, interesting.
And what's the name of this one again?
This one's called La Place's Demon.
La Place's Demon.
All June 13th to 16th, they're going to
be releasing. Get yourself to Portland.
Yeah, come. We'd love to have you come by. And if you're
to Portland.
If you're a Portland listener, maybe you'll join us. We're hoping to get some interviews with the people involved, and so stay tuned for that.
Let's go down our list really fast before we leave tonight. Before we wrap up, let's hip folks again to the best films of the front end of the Golden Age of Horror. What did you have, Eric?
I had The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
Awesome film.
I had Nosferatu.
Also awesome.
I also had Phantom of the Opera.
Phantom of the Opera.
I also had Haxan, actually.
All right, so I had Haxan, Phantom of the Opera, and The Golem, Der Golem, How He Came Into the World. Check out all these films. Yeah. You won't be disappointed by any of them.
Yeah, they are important to everything we love today. And
they're solid. They're still solid.
And at this point, we are stating for the record, we are benchmarking Phantom of the Opera as the start of horror films for the golden era.
Yes.
Next time around, we'll return to this and talk about the peak horror films. So, Mike, Have you got...
I'm going to take us out. I will take us out tonight. So, before we go, we've been trying to hip you to a fun little tagline from a fun little horror movie. Each night before we go, each podcast before we go, a tagline to this 1985 film by pick, by axe, by sword. Bye-bye. That's Mutilator, 1985.
Perfect closeout.
Bye-bye.